I did say to you we had one more guest to speak to on the programme. Now, the figure who embodied the militant and controversial spirit of the Black Panther Party more than anybody else was Eldridge Cleaver. Charismatic, brilliant and courageous, Cleaver built a base of power and influence that struck fear deep in the heart of white America. This is an amazing story and I'm looking forward to getting stuck right in between the pages of this book. A book by the name of Revolution or Death, The Life of Eldridge Cleaver, is written by Justin Gifford, who joins me by Skype right now. Justin, good evening and welcome to the programme. Thank you for talking to us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I suppose it's good morning in your land, is it?
It is. I just warmed up to a cup of coffee. We're about 9:30 a.m. here.
Okay. Anyway, that's good. Enjoy the coffee. I have one here beside me that's gone so cold since I made it, but there you go. This man, Eldridge Cleaver, just the very sound of his name kind of makes you wonder, you know, could he ever have been a priest? I mean, it's just that kind of name, isn't it?
Sure. Well, actually, Eldridge is an Anglo-Saxon name going back 1,000 years that means noble ruler. So depending on your view of his auspicious career, you could either say it's the most fitting name he could have possibly had or one of the most ironic names of all time.
What made you decide to write a book about this man? And we'll talk about the bad things that he did. And maybe there were some good things, too.
Yeah, sure. Well, it started off as a relatively straightforward research project when I began. At Berkeley, they have all of his papers. And when I say all of his papers, I mean about 50 boxes worth of unpublished manuscripts, FBI files that were kept on him, poetry, letters, these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so it began as pretty much a straightforward deep dive into that material. But where the project really got going was I went to Algeria to see where he had lived. He had fled from the police and the FBI in the late 60s after he got in a shootout with the Oakland police officers. Mm-hmm. And then fled the country. And so I went to go see the archives in Algeria. And while I was there, I was able to get a hold of his son, who's living in Saudi Arabia at the time. So he agreed to come meet me. We met in Casablanca, Morocco.
All right, as you do.
As one does. Yeah. And we began, had about a week together interviewing. And from there, he gave me a contact to his mother, Kathleen Cleaver, who was also a revolutionary. And then she turned out to have hundreds of boxes in her attic. So she let me come and sort through those for a couple of years. And now we have this book.
I didn't know that you went and met his son. So if we can talk about that meeting and the time that you spent with him initially, and then we'll talk about what's in the book and where it started and all that. For this man, what was his name? What is his name?
His name was Maceo.
Maceo.
Also, he went by Ahmad as well.
Okay.
And he actually died about 3 months after I interviewed him of a heart condition. So I really was one of the last people to get to talk to him. He had been a devout Muslim and in college, and then he decided to move to Saudi Arabia where he became a beekeeper. And I was able to find his email address by just pure luck and emailed him, and then he decided to come see me in Morocco and live together in an apartment for a week while we did these intensive interviews about his father.
And what was his attitude to his father? What did he think of his father?
I mean, one of the things that was really interesting is, you know, all of the kind of public information about Eldridge Cleaver really does focus on the more notorious parts of his personality. You know, his position as a political revolutionary. He had been in prison for over a decade. He later converted to Christianity and became a born-again Christian. So there's a lot of negative feeling toward Eldridge Cleaver in the public sphere. But Maceo was, you know, deeply moved by his father and gave me a very different portrait of the man, one who is a serious scholar, someone who is deeply committed to the liberation of Black people. And this was not a side of Cleaver that one normally sees in public discourse, but he gave me a real clear insight into him as like from a personal perspective.
If you hadn't met Maceo, this book would be different. Would it be very different if you hadn't met him?
It would be very different. I mean, not only because of his personal insights that he gave me on the book, but like I said, he connected me with Kathleen Cleaver. And I would say half of the book is based on the archive that she gave me access to. And it's an archive that's not available to the public. It was just in her attic, you know, just rotting away. And so had I not had that access to that archive, I wouldn't have all of the personal letters from Cleaver. I wouldn't have all of the, you know, the deeply personal correspondences between him and his wife, between him and his followers. So the rich detail in the book really does come out of that relationship with Maceo.
Okay. Where does the book start?
The book starts with him actually escaping from the police in 1968. The day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, Cleaver decided, let's get a bunch of brothers together and we're going to start a war with the Oakland police. And hopefully this will start a revolution across the United States.
Right.
So he got a bunch of guys together. They found an Oakland police officer and they just opened fire on them. And he was jailed for this offense. He was let out on parole. He was actually forced to go back by the courts, but instead of showing up for his release date, he had an acting troupe from San Francisco dress him up as an old man, complete with colostomy bag, and put him on a plane to New York, where he jumped the border, boarded a steamer ship, and headed to Cuba, where he stayed for a year before going to Algeria.
Okay, we'll pick that up in just a moment. Let's go back a little bit beforehand. How did he find himself in a position where he could lead a raid on a police station in Oakland in 1968?
Sure. So he was in prison from the mid-50s until the late 60s, 1966, 1967. As soon as he got out of prison, he decided he wanted to pick up where Malcolm X had left off and start his own Malcolm X style organization. It really wasn't working out for him. He wasn't really finding a lot of traction. And it was at that moment that he met Bobby Seale and Huey Newton, the founders of the Black Panther Party, and became their minister of information. So he was really the voice of the Black Panther Party, especially after Huey Newton was jailed for a murder of an Oakland police officer named Fry. And Cleaver really took over at that point as the leader of the organization.
Okay, and he was in prison until 1967. Was it a criminal act that he was in prison for, or had it anything to do with trying to start his movement?
No, he was a petty criminal.
Okay,
he had been arrested since the time he was 14 years old for things like vandalism. And then as he got older, as an adult, he was arrested for assault with the intent to commit murder. He was assaulted. He was arrested for rape. So he was like a really bad dude throughout the 1950s. Once he got to prison, however, that's when he started to kind of gain a political consciousness. He got some readings from a fellow inmate on Karl Marx. He got some readings from Machiavelli. He started reading Western philosophy and literature. And for about 10 years, he built up this vast library of theory and literature, which helped kind of convert him to the political cause of black people.
All right. So he headed off to Cuba. And as you say, he spent a year there. But while he was in Cuba, he was still obviously very active for the Black Panthers.
Yeah. And in fact, what happened was that the reason he went to Cuba in the first place is that Castro had promised him a guerrilla training facility that he would be able to train Black Panthers on the island and then bring them back to the United States, where they would stay in the Appalachian Mountains, where they would conduct raids on police stations.
Right.
This never materialized, and Cleaver was deeply disappointed because Castro was trying to be very cautious about inciting the wrath of the United States. So he never followed through on his promise, and after a year, Cleaver left to go to Algeria. But he kept on with this plan. I mean, his plan, more than all the other Black Panthers, was to overthrow the United States government through violent force. And he kept pursuing that all the way up until the end of his time in Algeria, which was in the mid-70s.
If I'm not mistaken, there were branches of the Black Panthers in Algeria and in the UK, am I right?
You know, I'm not sure about the UK. Okay. I know that they were all over Europe, in Sweden and in such places. There was actually a very robust Black Panther presence in Europe at the time. And he was basically kind of leading that coalition during his time in the international Black Panther section in Algeria. In fact, the Algerian president gave them a whole kind of compound where they could run their operations. And so they were able to build up quite an organization throughout the early 70s there.
Can you imagine the havoc that he would have reaped or wreaked if he had today's technology with social media available to him?
I mean, that was the big issue for him always was, you know, they back in those days, they used telephones and telex. And these are technologies that are incredibly expensive. And so he was always out of money. He got $500 a month stipend from Algeria, but that wasn't enough to live on, especially because he had dozens of Panthers who had hijacked planes and come to Algeria to join his cause. So if he had free technology, it's no telling what kind of organization he could have built.
Okay, so he's in Algeria for a number of years. He's helping to build this organization, particularly in Europe and in the United States. And then he leaves Algeria and goes to France. Why did he do that?
So a couple of things happen. The first is that all during this time that I'm talking about, the FBI is keeping close tabs on both Huey Newton and Cleaver and sending each letters ostensibly from the other person trying to undermine their authority.
Okay, right.
And this actually works. Actually, in 1971, the international section led by Cleaver and the domestic section led by Newton split, and there is no resolution to be had. In fact, they start murdering each other's followers in the wake of this split. So the first major reason that falls apart is because of the FBI. And then the other thing is that Cleaver has all of these Black Panthers hijacking airplanes and getting ransom between $500,000 and $1 million. And he wants that money. And so he actually demands the money from the president of Algeria, who is none too pleased by this belligerent action. And he threatened Cleaver's life. And Cleaver eventually in mid-70s, 1975, has to flee for his life to go to Paris.
Okay.
And that's where he stays for a couple of years.
Right. And when he finally leaves Paris or France and heads back to the United States, he's a completely different person by all accounts. Do we know what the transformation was?
I mean, there's a couple of things going on. I mean, he comes back. It's the height of the born again movement. I mean, even Jimmy Carter, the president at this point, says that he has a new relationship with Jesus. So something like a third of Americans at this point are identifying as evangelicals. And so he thinks, well, I can cash in on this by becoming a preacher. Both of his grandfathers were preachers in the South when he was growing up, and he had great respect for them. So it's not a total farce that he would become a preacher, but once he came back, the Panthers didn't want to have anything to do with him. The left didn't want to have anything to do with him. And he was really left with no options. And so because of that, he turned toward becoming a preacher, a born-again Christian preacher, and going on a preaching circuit in order to make money.
Okay. So was he all about image? Was he all about prestige? Was he all about money? Or was there actually something there that he believed in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's one of the questions of the book is, you know, how much substance is there to this person? And I go back to the archives that I was able to look at, you know, the personal archives, not just the stuff that's available in the library, but things that were held onto by his wife and his son. And all of those documents seem to indicate that he had a deep belief in the liberation of Black people. And how he went about doing that changes radically from one moment in his life to the next. But I think that through line of him wanting to transform Black America is a constant in his life. Now, some might say, you know, once he goes to the preacher part of his life, that he's really selling out. But he always talked about, you know, going from a Marxist materialist interpretation of history to a spiritualist interpretation of history. And while to people on the left really criticized him for that, I think that in his own mind and heart, he was deeply sincere.
Hmm. After writing the book, is he somebody that you liked?
I don't like anybody that I write about.
please don't ever write about me.
I mean, part of the point of the kind of work that I do is to take people who are really deeply challenging to our beliefs and our ideologies and try to understand what their motivations are, what their story is, and try to have a more kind of humane understanding of these folks. Cleaver is a person who I read in college, and I was deeply moved by Soul on Ice, his famous book, but I was also deeply disturbed by the sexual violence that seemed to kind of haunt and surround him throughout his life.
Okay.
So it's less for me about liking him, though there are moments where I think he acts heroically. I think it's more about trying to understand not only the person, the complex, contradictory person, but also the time and space that he comes from.
All right. He died in 1998. How did that come about?
So a couple of things contributed to his death. He was deeply into the crack cocaine scene in Oakland throughout the 80s and 90s, and that really deteriorated his health. He also had untreated cancer. And in fact, in one of the last pieces of information I was able to find on him, he writes a letter to his daughter saying, "I just can't afford these treatments. And so I'm going to go to this alternative medicine store and take these herbs and hopefully that will make my cancer go away." And of course, as we all know, that's not really an effective method or a consistently effective method for treating cancer. And so he died pretty soon thereafter.
Okay. All righty. Listen, it sounds like a fascinating story. How long did it take you to put that together? Because there was a huge amount of research in it.
Yeah, it was about 5 years from front to back on this. I started in 2015 and we're now seeing the book come out this week. So, yeah, about 5 years.
When you're waiting for the book to come out, are you nervous?
Oh, man. All you do is be nervous for this whole process. You're nervous while you're writing it. Is this going to be something that people want to read? You're nervous when you finish it because once it's out there in the world, it's out there permanently. Mm-hmm. And you're even nervous once it comes out because you're like, how will people receive this? Will people read it? Will people review it? So it's just one nerve-wracking moment after the next when it comes to writing a book. But there's also moments like this where you get to talk to people about the book and share it with audiences. And that's incredibly exciting.
Great. Well, the book is called Revolution or Death, The Life of Eldridge Cleaver. It's available in all good bookstores if they're open during COVID-19 restrictions and indeed all of the online platforms that you could think of, including the TRE website at tre.radio. I wish you well with it, Justin. Thanks very much for talking to us. It's a fascinating story and I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thanks so much. It's been a real joy to be with you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Justin Gifford, the author of that book.